Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming to today's Bit Information webcast. My name is Benjamin Chi. I'm with NERA Economic Consulting. NERA is the Procurement Administrator for the Illinois Power Agency. Today's webcast is about the Fall 2023 Index REC RFP. Presenting with me on this webcast is Mr. Anthony Starr with the IPA, as well as Ms. Katie Olandi from NERA as well. A couple of housekeeping items before we start. First, the biggest takeaway I think on this slide is do not worry about taking notes. The presentation, the audio recording or the video recording, as well as any Q&As, they will all be posted to the RFP website. The URL is found at the bottom of this slide too. You can access the materials and the call after this webcast presentation this afternoon. So just have that ease in mind that these materials will be available to you for access after this presentation. Throughout this presentation, you may ask your questions to us at any point in time. To do so, simply click on the chat icon at the bottom of the screen. A pop-up should appear, usually on the right. Type in your questions and then hit enter. Reference any slide numbers if you could so that we know what you're referring to. We'll start here on this slide three with one disclaimer. The first thing to note is that this entire Index REC procurement is pursuant to the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act, also known as Public Act 1020662. The governing documents governing this procurement process include not only Public Act 1020662, but also the 2022 long-term plan that has been filed by the IPA, has been approved by the Illinois Commerce Commission in docket number 22-0231, as well as all of the RFP materials that we have finalized and have posted to the website on Friday, September 29. They include the RFP rules and appendices, as well as the final REC contract. You, as the bidders, you will bear the full responsibility for reviewing and understanding these documents. So here is a disclaimer. Any statements that we make in this presentation, on this call, that refer to these governing documents, including the RFP as well as the Index REC agreement, they are summaries only, and they are qualified in their entirety by our reference to these documents. All of these documents have been posted and can be found on our website, and the URL is found again on this slide three. So here is a screenshot of the RFP website. There is a procurement website. The address is found here on this slide four, ipa-energyrfp.com. Very importantly, the final materials are those that have been posted as of September 29. The easiest way to get to the information is look to the left navigation bar, click on where you see Index Wind, Solar, and Brownfield. A sub navigation bar should appear. Click on Final Materials, and you should find the final set of documents posted. There are also a couple of red line documents for those of you who have been following us since the last procurement. These red line documents are provided to facilitate your review of the changes since the last procurement. And in summary, for your convenience, I will state up front that the REC contract, for example, have been modified to reflect administrative updates and dates only. There are really some non-substantive cleanups, but besides that, they follow the terms and conditions as you have seen from previous. So there's really not much that has changed since the last procurement. And for those of you who are new, this is the fourth round that we are running for this Index REC procurement. So we have held two in 2022 2022. We have concluded one earlier this year, and this is the fourth round of the index rack procurement. So for those of you who are looking at the time and trying to plan your time here with us, we have 68 slides. The first 34 slides, roughly half, we will cover the regulatory background and context. We will give you a high-level view of the procurement event and the process, and then we will take a deep dive into the relevant portions of the supplier contract to discuss the terms of this transaction, and we will talk about the contract provisions. And then the latter half of this presentation will be really covering the requirements and the deadlines for the RFP, sort of addressing the what and the how and the when questions regarding the RFP requirements and process. And then we will end off this presentation with the bids and post-bid process and open up a time for Q&A after. So without further ado, I'd like to invite Mr. Anthony Starr from the Illinois Power Agency to give us the regulatory context and to say a few words here about the procurement. Mr. Starr?
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chi. And thank you, everybody, for participating today in this webcast and our upcoming Index Rec procurement. So for a little background, the Illinois Power Agency is the state agency that has a significant role in implementing the state's renewable portfolio standard. And since 2017, after the enactment of the Future Energy Jobs Act, we have been doing procurements for RECs from new utility scale wind, utility scale solar, and brownfield site projects through a competitive procurement process. There were significant changes made in 2021 with the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act that shifted our procurement process and what we're procuring from a fixed REC model to an indexed REC model. And we'll be getting into that later in the presentation. We took the provisions that were in the law when it changed in 2021, and those will run through what is known as our long-term renewable resources procurement plan, which is the document the agency develops every 2 years to guide our renewable energy activities. The current plan that's in effect, the 2022 plan, we filed it with the Illinois Commerce Commission in March of last year. It was approved last summer. We did have a modification to that plan take place this year, so the current plan is what's known as the final modified long-term plan that was released in May of this year. The changes in that modified plan have to do with what's known as the adjustable block program, our program to incent the development of distributed generation and community solar. So those the changes that are in that modified plan in no way impact any of the procurements that we're issues that we're discussing today. The plan calls for a schedule of annual procurement, biannual procurement. And as Mr. Che mentioned, this is the fourth procurement event we've held under this structure. If you go to the link at the bottom of this page, you can go and look at the results of the previous three procurement events. Next slide, please. So while in theory, the plan is updated every 2 years, we're a little off cycle on that due to when CJO is enacted. So even though we only approved finalized a plan last summer, we're now actually in the process of developing a new long-term plan that will cover our activities for 2024 and 2025. We released a draft of that plan in August. Stakeholder comments on that draft plan were due on this past Friday. We're getting ready to revise that plan and file it for the ICC approval in October 20th, and that plan will then be approved in February of next year. That plan will then lay out the timeline for what we expect will be our procurements for the next 2 years, as well as paints a bit of a picture of what we expect would be approved or proposed by the agency in subsequent two-year cycles of the long-term plan. Basically, our proposal is to continue this model of twice-a-year procurements, but that's subject to the approval by the Commerce Commission, both for the 2024 plan and then in subsequent plans in years ahead. A significant issue that I believe many people on this call are aware of is some of the challenges we continue to see around the budget for the renewable portfolio standard, and in particular, the impacts on the budget from indexed REC, the indexed REC model, in that we collect a set amount or more accurately, the utilities collect from their ratepayers every year a RPS funds based upon a collection rate, and there's a cap for how much those collections can be. However, we don't necessarily know what future prices for index directs will be because they move as energy prices move. So if there's extended periods of very low electricity prices, index direct prices will be higher, and vice versa. The modeling that's contained in Chapter 3 of the plan illustrates what that volatility could look like. We also had issued a budget update in April of this year that it included other scenarios as well. But basically, if there are significant changes in future energy prices, it could lead to budget shortfalls in future years. Ultimately, we think that there's going to need to be legislation to address this. The current RPS budgeting model creates these risks that were an unintended consequence of the change to the index direct model. So while we certainly can't predict what or when the Illinois General Assembly will take action on this, our expectation is that there will be future legislation to address and reduce and hopefully eliminate this risk. Next slide, please. One more thing I wanted to mention is some resources that are available. Later in the webcast, there'll be discussion of the minimum equity standard and workforce requirements that go along with projects that are participating in this procurement. But I wanted to highlight two different resources from the agency that will be helpful as you sort of delve into what these requirements mean and what their implications would be for the projects that you might submit. First is our minimum equity standard page on our website, which is where we have all the information compiled about what the minimum equity standard is and the various documents and training guides of that would be used for a winning bidder for submitting the required plans and documents for those. We also have the Energy Workforce Equity Portal. This is a portal where companies can come in and both offer job postings for what are known as equity eligible persons, which is sort of the standard we use for workforce equity in Illinois, as well as it's a place where people can go and look up to see and register to become considered equity eligible person, which certainly would help aid in their availability as potential workers for future projects. So these are two important resources that are outside the procurement process per se that we're talking about today, but are very, very useful and very, very important to help interested parties understand what these important equity goals are for the agency and for the Illinois RPS. And with that, I'll turn it back to Mr. Chi.
Thank you, Mr. Starr. So for the rest of today's presentation, the direction of travel again is to talk about these procurement events at a high level. We'll delve into the contract and then we'll talk about the RFP specifically. So a couple of highlights here on this slide 8. So first thing to note is that there is going to be a qualification process that precedes your submission of bid. The bid date is on December 8th. And the biggest takeaway I hope to provide to you here is that we're looking for a very short turnaround between when you submit your bids and when you will receive a signed contract. And that is roughly about 10 calendar days. So we're not looking for a long review, evaluation, approval process. If you bid on December 8th, you will receive a signed contract if awarded before Christmas this year. So that's what we are looking at. This process is for a 20-year REC delivery contract. The targets we have here are targets based on a REC delivered annually basis, and we are looking for each of the 20 years roughly for wind, about 5.6 million RECs to be delivered annually, utility scale solar projects to deliver about 1.1 million RECs annually, and for brownfield site photovoltaic projects, about 127,000 RECs to be delivered annually for each of these 20 years. Very key is that these categories, utility scale wind, solar, as well as brownfield site PV projects, they do not compete against each other, but they compete within their own category. So if you have a wind project, you're not competing against a solar project. You're only competing with other utility scale wind projects. We are looking to procure RECs from projects that are selected through this RFP. The counterparties to the contracts are Ameren Illinois, ComEd, and Mid-American Energy Company. On bid day, we'll be asking for the projects that you're proposing three items. So three components to your bids. The first is a strike price on a dollar per megawatt hour basis. This strike price is a bundled energy and REC price that you will name. This is the strike price that we will be looking to evaluate. This is not the price you'll be paid. You'll be paid the difference between this strike price and something called the index price or the real-time LMP from an index hub. There are two index hubs that you can choose from. This is stated in the law. And the two index hubs are either the PJM Northern Illinois hub or PJM NI hub or the MISO Illinois hub. So these are the only two choices you have. You elect them at your own choice, and then that will become part of how we calculate the pricing for your RECs. And then the last component is really the quantity that you're committing to for each year throughout the 20 delivery years to come once your project is energized. The full quantity is the annual number of RECs you're committing to deliver each year. And then we will also ask you for a minimum quantity. This minimum quantity is simply the number of RECs on an annual basis that you're willing to accept as a partial award if we can accept not all, but only some of the quantities that you have indicated as your full quantity. So this is only affecting one party, the marginal bidder that has the marginal project. That if we were to accept, will get us to the target or slightly above the target. That's what we are after. So you will name these three items as a recap: the strike price, a quantity that you're committing to for each of these 20 years, and an index hub so that we know how to calculate the difference in price to pay you. And I'll get into the details in the next couple of slides. So here, I will describe what utility-scale projects mean, and then I will talk about brownfield site photovoltaic projects. So when we talk about utility-scale projects, all that we are talking about as defined in the law, in the IPA Act, is really renewable projects that are energized by wind or solar, PV in particular, that are 5 megawatts AC rating and above. So that's how we define a utility scale project. There are locational requirements. Throughout the bid process, you have to provide us the site in which your project will be developed. And the only requirement under the contract is that 50% of the project, once it is built, must be located in the site that you have identified in your proposal. But besides that, there is no restriction to any size changes after the award. For the location, it must be located in Illinois or an adjacent state for these utility scale projects. If it is in an adjacent state, it must meet the public interest criteria. So let me unpack this a little bit. Basically, if it is in Illinois, you're all set. If it is in an adjacent state, in a state that adjoins, has a border bordering Illinois, adjacent to Illinois, then what it means is that you have to submit a spreadsheet to the IPA. IPA will evaluate and then will provide you an evaluation whether the project in this adjacent state would qualify or not. So, for example, if you have a project in Michigan, what I would say is don't second guess whether the project is eligible for this procurement or not. Simply fill up the spreadsheet, submit it to the Illinois Power Agency. They will tell you whether it meets the public interest criteria. If it meets the public interest criteria, then we will accept it into the procurement as though it's an Illinois project. What we mean by that is that you will not be disadvantaged in terms of the evaluation whether it's a project that is in ad adjacent to Illinois or an Illinois project, they're treated more or less the same. These are new projects that we are after, and the definition in the law would tell us that the date of first operation of these projects must be after June 1st, 2017. I'm highlighting this only to let you know that if you already have projects that are energized at this point in time, but the date of first operation is after June 1st, 2017, and you're looking for a REC offtake agreement, by all means, feel free to submit your project for consideration in this RFP process. They would be considered new and they would be eligible for entry into our procurement. Your projects must also be subject to a PLA, or what we call the Project Labor Agreement Act requirements. You must be paying prevailing wages for construction activities, and you'll be subject to a minimum equity standard of 10%. And I will get to all of these when we talk about the contract shortly. But just take notes, there are these labor requirements as part of your participation for the award. If it is a solar project, then it must be installed by qualified persons as defined in the law. And if it is a utility scale project, and you are submitting or proposing the project to be developed in what we call the ETCG area, the Energy Transition Community Grant area, you would qualify for a price reduction during the bid evaluation process to make your project look more competitive. It doesn't discount how much we're going to pay you. It's just for evaluation purposes, so that you could be considered more favorably for an award. So that's how it will work. We will talk about the specifics of bid evaluation later on in this presentation as well. For brownfield site photovoltaic projects, I'm going to highlight only a couple of key changes vis-à-vis the utility scale projects. First, unlike utility scale, there's really no size requirement. If you want to build something less than 5 megawatts, it is considered eligible under the law. They must be located in Illinois and must be entirely contained within the brownfield site that you have proposed. There is a definition for what constitutes as a brownfield site or not. We'll get to that. But you'll be asked to provide supporting documentation to demonstrate to us that the site is indeed a brownfield site as defined in the law. And for this, to be very clear, we are not looking to qualify any brownfield sites that are adjacent to Illinois. They must be in Illinois state. In terms of the product requirements, we are looking for you to transfer RECs to us. The RECs must include all environmental attributes. They must be from the project. We're not looking for replacement RECs through this process, and they must be from the project specifically selected for an award through this RFP. When you energize the project, you will be asked to also sign up for a standing order with GETS or MRETS. And the standing order will transfer those RECs once they are issued by GETS or MRETS into the utilities account once they are issued month by month. These RECs will allow the buyer to comply with the Illinois RPS. And in terms of the vintage requirements, the earliest vintage we are after, if your project is already energized, then it will start with the earliest vintage of January 2024. But this is not the standard for all projects. We do allow for a period in which development will take place before delivery will proceed. So if your project is not yet developed, this is probably the type of projects we are contemplating here for the most part. And the first REC delivery must occur by May 31st, 2028. If you cannot deliver your first REC to the utilities by May 31st, 2028. Then there is a extension. This is a no questions asked, no justifications needed extension that will push out the first REC delivery deadline to May 31st, 2030 in exchange for increased collateral. So I will talk about what this collateral requirement is when we get to the contract stage. And if you still cannot deliver your first REC by May 31st, 2030, there are requests that you can make to the IPA for good cause, and these are described further in the index REC contract. And we do allow for these extensions for good cause. If it is not your fault, you try to energize the project and you're not getting the permits and there are delays. We do recognize for those types of situations. And the last date in which we will have to pull the trigger to terminate the contract is in 2035. So it's way out into 2035 before the contract will be terminated and the collateral will turn back to you if you cannot energize your project by then. But here are pretty much the basic timeline for a regular project that we expect to energize and to start delivering RECs. In terms of the proposal, the RFP process, there's going to be a two-part process. Part one is for you to respond to qualification standards. We'll ask you for basic information about your company, who the seller is, who the bidder is, as well as something about your project. Tell us about where this project is located, what the size of the project is, and basic information so that we know whether this is a utility scale wind project or a solar project, and whether you have site control. So everything is done online. The part one window is between October 17 to October 31st at noon. This is a noon central deadline. So whatever you do, don't miss the October 31st noon deadline for part one submission. Again, everything is done online. The only thing that is not done online is probably the payment of something called the bid participation fee that I will talk about in the next slide. Part two is when qualified bidders, if you have submitted your qualification materials, have been qualified and notified by us that you've been qualified, then part two is for you to provide additional information in your part two stage, complete additional forms, sign them, scan them up, upload them, and then to submit the bid assurance collateral to each of the utilities, either cash or a letter of credit. The part two deadline is by noon on December 1st. This again is a noon deadline. Everything is done online, even the LC. There is a you can do a cash transfer or an electronic LC that we will explain in a little bit. And the proposal submission process is entirely online. And the only thing that is really hard copy, if you need to, is really the bid assurance collateral or for the letter of credit. In terms of evaluation, what we're looking here is again for you to provide three items: the quantity, the price, and the index hub. What will actually be evaluated by us in each of these categories, whether it's wind or solar or brownfield, is something called the strike price. The strike price is again a bundled energy and REC price. That is what we mean when we say bids are evaluated on a price-only basis. We're looking at the strike price in this case. And in two scenarios, your strike price will be adjusted by us. The two scenarios are whether you commit to a equity standard beyond the 10% minimum equity standard. 10% is the minimum that all projects have to meet. If you submit or commit to something greater than 10%, you're eligible for a price reduction for purposes of evaluation. And similarly, if your utility scale wind or solar project is located in a ETCG grant area, these Energy Transition Community grant areas, then it will also be eligible or qualify for these bid price adjustments for purposes of evaluation. At that point, all strike price or adjusted strike price must meet or beat the confidential benchmarks to be considered, and then we will look to rank all the bids and select bids for award based on whether you eligible for the award, taking the projects with the lowest strike price first. There'll be no post-bid negotiations, and we have a evaluation that looks to hit these targets that I've mentioned earlier as close as we can, but we may go a little bit above that if we need to select a marginal project that is right at the margin where by accepting it will cause us to go a little bit above the target. And we will talk about that a little bit. For the full evaluation criteria, we have an Appendix 15 to the RFP rules that discusses that. So there are two types of fees that you are kind of responsible for. First, as a bidder, all bidders have to pay what we call a bid participation fee. This entry fee or bid participation fee is $500. It is paid directly to the Illinois Power Agency. And this fee is paid once only for all procurements in 2023 calendar year. So if you have already paid this fee in an earlier procurement this year, you're done. You don't need to pay this fee again. But if you're a new bidder coming in, then you will be subject to paying this $500. And this is tied to the bidder, not to the project. So if you have paid this fee for a different project, you're done as well. But if you are a new bidder participating with us for the first time, this will apply to you. The second fee that will be applicable is only applicable for winning projects. If you don't win, you don't pay. This is what we call a supplier fee. This is paid by winning projects. It is due within 7 business days after the award. The estimate at this time is 60 cents per rec of the annual quantity that you're awarded. So what we mean by that is that this is on an annual basis of recs to be delivered. So if you name in your bid form 100,000 recs, then all you do is you take 60 cents times 100,000 recs to get to the supplier fee that you're responsible to pay for to the IPA after the award. And again, if you have a project submitted but did not win, you do not pay the supplier fee. These are only for winning projects. Confirmation of the supplier fee will be provided to all bidders 2 business days prior to bid date. So the 60 cents at this time is simply an estimate. So I'm going to move things a little bit more concrete, and I'm going to take a deep dive so into the contract and to explain the structure of the REC contract as well as the principal terms of your engagement on the transaction here. So the REC contract has been posted online. It is dated September 29, and the key sections that I will flag for you here is section 2, where you will find information about the product that we are after, as well as mainly about the facility requirements. There are some representations that you have to make tied to the facility. Section 4 or Article 4 will talk about the key delivery obligations and requirements that you have to meet under the terms of the REC contract. What a shortfall means and what the penalties are if you fail to meet the delivery requirements. Article 5 will talk about payment and invoicing that will occur month by month under the REC contract. Article 6, you have a couple of labor requirements and reporting requirements. I encourage you to look at those requirements in Article 6. They will explain what your obligations are and when these reporting requirements are triggered and when you need to submit them to the buyer or the IPA. These are covered in Article 6. Article 7 deals with credit and collateral requirements. You have to post performance assurance under the contract, what they look like, and where you can find information. They're all talked about in Article 7. And we have a couple of exhibits as well. Importantly, you will find the credit instruments, whether it's a performance assurance, letter of credit, or a form of guarantee for your parental guarantee. They are all provided as standard forms you can download individually from the website or look at the back of the contract. There are also a couple of examples provided in Exhibit F to the contract that you can look to the extent that some of the concepts are unclear and how the calculations would ensue for delivery requirements. So when you are a seller that has been awarded a contract, take note that you will be signing not one contract for your project, but you'll be signing three contracts, one with each of the buyer utility companies, Ameren Illinois, Commonwealth Edison, and Mid-American Energy Company. You will have no choice, but you have to sign three contracts, one with each utility. Once you sign the contracts, then the contract administration will occur and be administered by these utilities separately and independently. The RECs they were after are from your winning projects. If you tell us it's 100,000 RECs you're committing to each year for a 20-year tenor, then the 100,000 RECs will be allocated across these three utilities of Ameren, ComEd, and Mid-American in some pro rata share of their load in the territory. So we will allocate them, and these annual numbers, once they're split, we will let you know in the contract, in the product order itself, how much is allocated to each of these companies. And then the payment, importantly, will be based on a price that will be calculated by the IPA and the quantity that is tied to the number of RECs that are delivered each month. So in terms of how this translate from bid to the contract more concretely, the annual quantity that you name in your bid form, again, for example, 100,000 RECs, will then be split across these three utilities, not in equal share, but in some share that we will provide to you in the product order. This is just illustrative. You will see about 27,000 of your 100,000 will go to Ameren, about 70% of it will go to ComEd, and a small number will go to Mid-American Company. The strike price, again, this is a bundled price for energy and RECs, will be provided in the product order or the transaction confirm, and this will be the strike price that will appear in all three contracts. If you tell us it's $30 per rack or megawatt hour, this $30 will appear in each of these three contracts. The hub, the Illinois hub or index hub at your choice will also be provided in the product order. In this example, between PJM 9 Hub and MISO Illinois Hub, the bidder chose MISO Illinois Hub. This index hub will also be reflected in the product order. So in each contract, you'll find the term annual quantity to mean the quantity that is allocated to the particular utility buyer. And then multiply that by 20, that becomes your maximum contract quantity, the maximum that the utility can pay out under the terms of that contract. All right, here we get to the payment mechanism. I think this is a very key slide, slide 22 here. I'll try my best to maybe start off by explaining what the design of the index REC mechanism is about for those of you who are new. So pay careful attention. This is perhaps the most important slide for you to understand conceptually what we are after in this index REC procurement. So in the procurement, again, you will name one of three items. The first item that is very key is something called the strike price. The strike price, again, is not the rack price. The strike price is a bundled price for energy and racks. This is very key. And the central question we are asking in the strike price here, you can think of it as us asking you, how much does it cost you to develop a project and to interconnect your project? And once it is energized, to maintain and operate this project for a 20-year duration. So again, the strike price is more or less a levelized cost of electricity that we are looking for, a cost of both energy and RECs, sufficient for you to develop the project and maintain it for a 20-year term, maintain and operate it for a 20-year term. And you know, for example, how many RECs your project will produce in the 20-year duration after energization. Take the entire cost of the development and operation for 20 years, divide that by the number of RECs, as well as add in a healthy rate of return that you think you will need to develop that project. That is more or less the strike price that we are after. I cannot tell you how to bid, but conceptually, I'm just trying to ensure that you understand that this is not a rack price that we are after, but a price for energy and racks sufficient for you to develop the project and to maintain it for a 20-year term. So the contractual and conceptual promise through this index rack mechanism, what we are trying to assure you is if the energy markets do not provide you sufficient revenues to get you to the strike price that you need to develop this project, we will make you whole to get you to the strike price through the index rack mechanism. So, through the index rack mechanism, to the extent that there is volatility in the energy markets, and in some years, you find that the energy revenues are insufficient to get you to the price that you need to develop and maintain this for a 20-year term, the difference is what the utilities to this contract will pay you to get to the strike price. And that is quite key. And the way that we assume what the energy payments are or the energy price will be the index, real-time index hub price that you have indicated to us on bid day, whether it's the Illinois, MISO Illinois hub or the PJM 9 hub that you want your price to be indexed to. So month by month, more than that, actually, hour by hour, what we will do is we will look at each hour what the index price is, whether it is the PJM 9 hub or the MISO Illinois hub. And we will compare that, and if the energy price at these hubs are less than your strike price, we will calculate the difference. The difference is what is due to you, and we will calculate the difference by using the real-time LMP at these hubs as a proxy to the revenues that you get from MISO or PJM. So you could get other payments from MISO or PJM if you get capacity payments or ancillary payments. By all means, keep them; they are yours. We don't ask that question, but all we do is we take the real-time LMP at these hubs as a proxy for calculation of the rack price. And these prices that we get from the index hub are known and they are publicly available. And all you are giving us is an indication or an election on bid day, whether it is the MISO Illinois hub or the PJM 9 hub that we are after. The second thing to note is that you have to manage the basis risk because you're not getting the price, the LNP, exactly at the hub. You're not building at the hub. You're building in Illinois and at the adjacent states. Whatever you get from PJM or MISO is the LNP that you get from PJM and MISO. So you have to manage the basis risk from the generation bus all the way to the hub. And we're only looking at the LNP at the hub to calculate the price. So again, we take the difference between the index price and your strike price. And at each hour, we will multiply that by the megawatt hour from your project at that hour to get to this component called the REC monthly price hourly component. We do this same calculation for every hour during the month. We sum all of these calculations up and then divide it by the megawatt hour of actual generation of the project in the month itself to get to a weighted average monthly price. These terms are defined terms in the contract. So if this is not clear, do refer to the contract. In Article 1 has a page where we list out all the defined terms and the definitions. So look at this term, REC monthly price hourly component, and the REC monthly price to get a sense of how these calculations are done. In terms of what you will invoice the utility counterparty, the price is how I just discussed here on this slide. And then the payments will consist of the price component and a quantity component. The quantity component is simply the RECs that are delivered for the vintage after the month is over. So those are the terms of how to calculate the invoice payment amount. So again, I think the key takeaway on this slide, if you understand the REC mechanism or the index REC mechanism, is that we are trying to guarantee you somewhat a way to get back to the strike price that you name in order for you to develop and maintain this project for a 20-year term, so that we will help you de-risk the energy price volatility. You don't need to follow the energy market, so to speak, but you have somewhat of a certainty that when the energy prices are depressed and you find it insufficient to develop and maintain the project, the utility contracts will come in to pay you the difference. And in times when the energy markets feature high energy prices above what you need to maintain the strike price, we ask for you to return those payments back to the ratepayers through this utility contract. So this is how the REC payments will work under the contract conceptually. In terms of invoicing and payments, I will kind of walk you through how this will work on a month-by-month basis. So if you have, for example, July 2024 as when your project has been energized and producing electricity, then this invoicing and payment diagram will recognize that electric production is different from REC issuance. So whenever there is a vintage month when the electricity is produced, you'll find a lag in terms of when the RECs are actually issued and delivered. So what we have here is an example, electricity produced in July. At the end of July, within 5 business days, we ask that you turn over the hourly generation data to the IPA. In this case, by August the 7th, 5th business day after the end of the electricity generation month, to give that over to the IPA so that they can calculate the RECs for vintages in July, electricity generation in July. The IPA will issue a notice to both buyer and seller to confirm what the July vintage price would be for these RECs by the 20th day of August. So you will expect 20 days after electricity generation, IPA will issue a REC price notice to buyer and seller. By the end of August, RECs are expected to be delivered in your GETS or MRETS account to the buyer counterparty through a standing order. Within 10 days of REC delivery, you should invoice the buyer counterparty and expect to be paid or pay the buyer counterparty as applicable by the end of the month. So, really, after REC delivery, expect invoicing to proceed within 10 days and payments to ensue by the end of the month when invoices are received. So that's pretty much the basic for invoicing and payment. Importantly, turn over all electric generation data on an hourly basis to the IPA within 5 business days after the electric generation month. Expect the notice to come from the IPA to tell you how much the RECs are worth for that, for those vintages. Here is a example. For example, here we have the IPA issuing by the 20th day something for the month of July, a REC price of 298. And here, this is where the payments are based on both a price that is calculated by the IPA and a quantity based on the number of RECs that have a July vintage. We expect that the RECs are delivered a month lagging behind when the electric generation would occur, and you will receive the price from the IPA before even the RECs are issued by MRETS or GETS. And then you multiply the two, that gives you the payment amount. And in this case, we ask that whether you are paying the buyer or buyer is paying you, whether the price is negative or positive, you, the seller, to invoice the buyer with that information. And if the price is positive, even if the price is positive, and you are making payments for those RECs, we request that you send the invoice to the buyer, but you may also request that the buyer issue an invoice for documentary purposes. In terms of the standing order, this is required. You will be signing on to a standing order before the delivery will occur. So once you have energized your project, you are to establish a standing order for the recurring transfer of your RECs to each of the buyer counterparty. There is one item I should note here that is kind of a flexibility that is provided for sellers in this procurement, which is that we could, but we are not obligated for you to commit 100% of your project's output to the IPA counterparties. You could have a commercial offtaker as well for your project. You could say that 20% belongs to a commercial offtaker that is not one of the three utilities. You don't need to tell us the identity of this other third-party offtaker, and you don't need to tell it to us when your project is awarded. We are only asking for you to tell us what that project committed percentage to the IPA is prior to the establishment of the standing order. So when you energize your project, when you develop your project, let us know what this percentage is. Once you set this percentage, you may tell us 80% belongs to the IPA going forward. Then that 80% will be translated to a percentage into the contract, and that cannot change for the life of the 20-year delivery term. So anything that is not transferred through the standing order, not part of the 80% in this example, belongs to you, and whatever that you do with that to with your commercial offtaker, that is your business. We really don't care about that. But that will not be considered as part of this procurement. But what we are after is the quantity that you name under the terms of your bid. So if you tell us 100,000 racks to be delivered, we are looking for you to deliver that, as we will talk about when we get to delivery obligations. The earliest vintage month that we are looking for, so that we know how to calculate the pricing for your racks, is January 2024. It could be after that, but no earlier than January 2024. And again, you need to establish the standing order within 30 days of the project's date of first operation. Once it is energized, we need to have the standing order established by you, but no earlier than January 1st, 2024, for those projects that are already energized. I'll talk about credit requirements here before we talk about delivery obligations. In terms of the credit requirements, there is performance assurance that is required of you. Once you're awarded, this credit requirement will kick in, and you need to provide the letter of credit or cash to the counterparty, buyer counterparty, after the award, with your contract execution. The minimum that we are looking for each contract would be $20,000. And the more exact calculation is really $4 times the annual quantity under the contract for utility scale projects. And if it's a solar project, whether it's utility scale wind, utility scale solar or brownfield, it is $10 of the annual quantity. To meet your collateral requirement, we do grant unsecured credit for investment grade counterparties, or if you're relying on a parental guarantee with a parent that is also investment grade. What we mean by investment grade is BBB- for S&P or Fitch, and Baa3 and above for Moody's. And the unsecured credit line that will be granted is called the collateral threshold. It is set at $2.5 million. So, as an example, if your collateral requirement is $2 million and you are credit worthy with investment grade, then you will get an unsecured credit line of $2.5 million, potentially not needing to put up any letter of credit or cash to meet the collateral requirement. The form of the guarantee, as well as the letters of credit to be used as performance assurance, are provided as exhibits to the REC contract. So you can find them at the end of the REC contract and appended as exhibits that you can use. If you're posting cash as pre-bid bid assurance collateral under the RFP, those can be converted into performance assurance collateral without you to post them separately if they are cash after the award stage. And more information will be provided to you more concretely when you're qualified as a bidder. But in general, you can find them in the RFP rules as well as in the contract, how the netting of these bid assurance and performance assurance collateral work if they are in the form of cash. In terms of delivery requirements, so we're talking about when your first delivery has to occur, as well as what the delivery requirements are after it has been energized. So one rack, we call it the initial rack delivery deadline. One rack must be delivered to each of the utility counterparties by May 31st, 2028. Your project must be energized before then for your racks to be delivered by this date. If you cannot meet this deadline for first rack to be delivered, then there is a no questions asked, no justification needed extension that pushes us out by 2 years to May 31st, 2030, in exchange for double of your collateral requirement. Any subsequent extensions you can request that by the IPA or to the IPA will be granted on a case-by-case basis that you will have to demonstrate for good cause, provided that you are not the cause of the delay. So good cause could include delays outside of your control in finalizing the interconnection agreements or installing the interconnection facilities, obtaining any permits or approvals, or delays in the issuance of the RECs from GETS or MRETs. The extensions will be for a period of 1 year at a time, and you can find more information in section 2.4 of the REC contract for this information. In terms of the delivery term and the acceptable vintage period, to put it more concretely, whenever your RECs are first issued by GETS or MRETs, that is what we call the start of the delivery term. In this case, energy is produced in January, RECs are issued in February. So whenever RECs are issued for the first time by GETS or MRETs, that triggers a term called the delivery term. That's the start of your delivery term. And the vintage for which these RECs are first issued is called the earliest vintage period. So in this case, it's January of 2024, also known again as the earliest vintage month. There is going to be a period of 241 months, what we call the acceptable vintage period. So it's a little bit more than 20 years. It's 20 years plus 1 month to ensure that you have a really broad timeline for what we consider as the acceptable vintage period. This is the period in which any RECs that are delivered to us, we will accept if it is in the acceptable vintage. And then the close of the delivery term is 3 months after the latest vintage month in the acceptable vintage period. So this is how we are considering the delivery term and the acceptable vintage period. Hope this is clear. And then what are you obligated to provide to us each year is something called the delivery year requirement. This is more or less the annual quantity that is allocated to each utility in the contract. The slight difference is for solar project. If it is a solar project, whether it's a brownfield project or a utility scale solar project, then we will adjust the annual quantity for a 0.5% degradation, where you will have to provide more RECs upfront in the earlier delivery years and less RECs in the latter delivery years. So that yearly requirement is what we call the delivery year requirement that you have to hit. If it is a wind project, there's no degradation. So your delivery requirement is simply your annual quantity in that contract. This entire schedule is provided to you in your product order when the contract is executed so that you have some certainty what your obligations are going forward each year. So here is the baseline. I'll talk about the baseline first, and then I'll talk about some of the flexibility that we afford to you. So the first baseline, the baseline is simply this, that if you fail to meet the delivery requirements for 3 or more years, and the cumulatively amount of the shortfall is at or exceed the annual quantity, then it becomes an event of default and a breach of your contractual terms. At that point, the contract will be terminated and the collateral requirement forfeited. So what we are after here is really that you are committed to the REC quantity that you bid on bid day. And that we're trying to avoid a case where we have bidders speculatively bidding higher amounts than they could deliver or intend to deliver. Because whatever that we award to you, it means that we are kicking someone else out. So we want you to be really serious about your bids. When you say 100,000 RECs to be delivered annually, we will hold you to do that. But we will afford you some flexibility because we understand that the resource is intermittent. So you cannot miss 3 or more times, and cumulatively, it cannot exceed the annual quantity. For the first year, there is no concept of a shortfall. And for the stub period that precedes the first full year, there is also no concept of a shortfall. So if you don't build your project or energize your project on June 1st, then you'll kind of have a stop here. If you energize your project in August of a year, then August through the following May is considered a stop period. And the June 1st through May 31st of the following year is considered the first full year. So the first full year and the stop period, you will not have any shortfall count against you. There's no concept of being short below the delivery requirement. If you meet the delivery requirement, we will pay you up to the delivery requirement. And the way that we calculate the delivery requirement is not when these RECs are delivered, but rather the REC vintage, meaning the energy in which the RECs are based on to calculate whether you meet the delivery requirement. It runs from June of a year through May of the following year. The other thing to note here in terms of just flexibility, as we talked about earlier, when you energize your project, we will ask you to tell us the project committed percentage. You can name 100%, and all that means is 100% of your project's output will go into the standing order to be transferred to the IPA utility counterparties here. But this project allows you to name a percentage for other off-takers as well, to be very clear. And so whatever that is not transferred as part of the committed percentage, they belong to you. You can use them however you want. And they are considered RECs that you can also use to meet the shortfall if you want to. So this is another flexibility for you to meet your obligations. If there are RECs that are outside of the acceptable vintage period, they are not eligible for transfer. These are considered ineligible RECs. If there are RECs that are in excess of your delivery requirement but are transferred pursuant to the standing order, these are considered excess RECs. And if transferred, please inform the buyer counterparty for these RECs to be returned back to you. The RECs that are transferred that are considered excess RECs and returned back to you, they are your property. You can use these excess RECs or RECs that you have previously committed to a commercial counterparty as an off-taker. You can use those RECs to meet any of your shortfall amounts as well. It is just that we cannot pay you for these shortfall amounts that are being replaced because we do not know how to pay you for which month. Because if you're short in a month, we will accept these replacement for your shortfalls, but we just cannot pay you for those shortfall amounts. There are also labor requirements as we end off this supplier contract section. We have two slides here on reporting requirements. So I'll cover here first on prevailing wage and labor project labor re requirements. So, prevailing wage act requirements apply to all projects, whether it is in Illinois or adjacent state. It will apply throughout the entire contract terms. You have to pay prevailing rate of hourly wages under this contract. This is due within 5 days of the date of first operation of your project, or if your project is already energized within 5 days of contract execution. If this is an adjacent state project, you need to provide these documentation and show that you have been paying prevailing wages that are prevailing where your project is sited. And if they are not available, to use the federal Davis-Bacon rates to comply with the Illinois PWA requirements. For the project labor agreement requirements, this is really to ensure that the project is built by general contractors that have entered into a project labor agreement prior to construction. So this is part of what is a statutory requirement. This is due within 30 days of the execution of the PLA or the later of the 60 days prior to the construction start date of these construction activities. So the PLA requirement are more fully fleshed out in section 6.3 of the REC contract. The PWA requirements are fully fleshed out in section 6.2 of the REC contract. And then I will talk about the minimum equity standard requirements here on the slide 32. This is applicable all the way through the date of first operation of the project as recorded by GETS or MRETS. Importantly, it will only be applicable for the period after December 15, 2022. So if you have any requirements before this date, December 15, 2022, and construction has already begun, the MES does not apply to that period before December 15, but it will apply for any construction activities after December 15, 2022, through the date of first operation of the project. So I'll tell you what the requirements are and what it tangibly means, and then where to look for more information. So the minimum equity standard is 10%. 10% means 10% of your project workforce must comprise of these equitable eligible contractors or persons. You'll find these definitions in the REC contract, more fully fleshed out in section 6.4. Look up again the definitions of equity eligible contractor, equity eligible persons, project workforce, construction activities. These few definitions and section 6.4 will more or less flesh out what the requirements are for you. If you are a equity eligible contractor at this time, then you already have met the 10% minimum equity standard, and you no longer need to meet any of the reporting requirements after that. If in this bid process you are committing to a higher equity level above the 10% minimum to qualify for a bid evaluation price reduction, then additional reporting requirements will apply, and you can find more information in section 2.5 of the REC contract. In general, in section 6.4 of the REC contract, you'll find these reports that are required of you. First and foremost, there is going to be a MES compliance plan. This is a forward-looking plan to tell us how you will comply with the MES for the construction of your project. And this first plan, first MES compliance plan, is due 30 days of bid approval, even if no construction activities are performed in this upcoming year. Please provide your first compliance plan to describe how best, as best as you can, how you're going to meet the 10% compliance of the minimum equity standard. Again, this is due within 30 days of bid approval. And beginning each delivery year, you will have to submit this compliance plan for that delivery year to tell us forward-looking how you're going to meet compliance of your MES with any revisions due by July 15 of that year. There is a mid-year check-in. We call it the mid-year MES confirmation due by December 1st of each delivery year to tell us how you are and whether you are on track or not to meet the MES for that delivery year. And once the delivery year has concluded, you'll be needing to provide a year-end MES report due July 15 after the year has concluded to inform us of how you have met the minimum equity standard, meaning that you have to provide information about how your project workforce is comprised of these EECs or EEPs for the construction activities that have occurred in that delivery year. Other reporting requirements will include in Section 6 as well of the REC contract, the monthly generation report. This is again to be submitted 5 business days after the electric generation vintage month. We need to know exactly on an hourly basis the megawatt hourly generation data of the project at the project P-note. This is so that we know how to calculate the price by taking the difference of the real-time LMP at the applicable index hub and your strike price to calculate the price that we'll pay you. For that, we will need read-only access for you to grant to buyer in the IPA through the PJM power meter system or the MISO market system for your project. You're encouraged to inform the IPA once the date of first operation has occurred so that we can start to put in place these calculation processes and no notice so that it will be seamless from energization to REC price calculation to REC invoice and payment after the first vintage has occurred. So that is what will be required of you in terms of reporting requirements. With that, I will now turn the time over to Ms. Katie Olandi, who will walk us through the more practical aspects of your participation in this RFP. I will now turn the time over to Ms. Olandi.
Thank you, Mr. Chi. So in this next portion of the presentation, I'm going to cover the practical aspects of qualifying a project and submitting a bid. So I'm going to cover the schedule, the process to register for an account. I'll walk through the details of the qualification requirements, and then I'll finish up with a final section on bid submission and evaluation. It should take no more than 30 minutes, hopefully less, and then we'll be able to open the floor to take some questions. So on this first slide here, we have the schedule. The RFP process kicks off on October 17th with the opening of the Part 1 window and proceeds over the next 2 months. So as Ben mentioned, the qualification process is in two parts. The first part is the Part 1 proposal when bidders submit their qualification materials, and applicants should begin submitting their materials when the window opens on October 17th. And then Part 1 proposals are due on the Part 1 date, which is Tuesday, October 31st. The bid participation fee of $500 is submitted as part of the Part 1 proposal and therefore is also due by this date. Applicants are given time to cure any deficiencies and respond to requests for additional information or clarification from the procurement administrator. And then by November 14th, the Part 1 notification date, applicants will be informed whether they've qualified to submit a Part 2 proposal. The Part 2 proposal includes posting bid assurance collateral with each company in the form of cash and a letter of credit. The Part 1 window opens on Wednesday, November 15th. And then closes on the Part 2 date on Friday, December 1st. Applicants that have a successful Part 2 proposal can submit bids on the bid date. And so that's the following Friday, December 8th. And we'll hold a training session on December 5th, where qualified bidders can ask questions regarding completing and submitting the bid form and can practice all aspects of submitting their bid form as they would on the bid date. Bids selected on the bid date are subject to approval by the Illinois Commerce Commission, and the Illinois Commerce Commission is expected to release its decision on the results of the RFP on Thursday, December 14th. So in order to submit a bid for a project in the RFP, a bidder must submit a proposal via the online proposal forms. So to register for an account to access the online proposal forms, please visit the procurement website, ipa-energyrfp.com, and fill out the qualification registration form under the Contact Us page. You'll select the appropriate category, index wind, solar, and brownfield. Provide the number of projects for which you intend to submit a proposal. A separate proposal must be submitted for each project, so you will be provided access to multiple proposal forms through a single account. And you'll also be asked to provide your name, company name, email address, and phone number. Alternatively, you can send an email to illinois-rfp@nero.com with the information requested on this slide. Just be sure to include the number of projects. And so at this time, I'd really like to encourage everyone on this call that plans to participate to go ahead and request accounts as soon as practicable. So we're going to issue one account per company, and the information to activate the account will be sent to the individual that registers for an account. This individual will receive an email with account activation instructions from info@ipa-energyrfp.com, as shown in the screenshot below. The individual that registers for an account will also receive an email with a guide with screenshots that will walk you through account activation and instructions for how to complete and submit the form and for paying the bid participation fee. We'll begin issuing accounts when the Part 1 window opens in mid-October, and then we'll issue accounts within 24 hours of receipt of registration throughout the Part 1 window. One final slide on this. Once you have an account, you can access the online form to work on your proposal in two ways. You can go directly to the web address provided here, forms.ipa-energyrfp.com, or you can access this website through the procurement website by clicking on the qualification form subpage within the indexed REC wind, solar, and brownfield section of the website. So moving on, in this next section, I'm going to walk through the details of the qualification requirements. This slide provides some general information before we go into specific requirements. So for purposes of your proposal, the bidder is the entity that submits the proposal, and the seller is the entity that signs the index rec contract if the project is selected. If there are multiple projects and sellers, then these entities are not required to be the same. And I'll provide some more information on naming the bidder and seller on the next slide. A Part 1 proposal consists of information submitted through the online form, supporting documents that are uploaded to the online form, and then inserts that are also uploaded. So supporting documents and inserts can also be emailed to us. Inserts are documents that we provide to you in Word format and need to be filled in and in some cases signed by an authorized individual. These inserts are posted to the procurement website, and they're grouped by category of project as shown in the screenshot here. So either wind, solar, or brownfield. So please do download the appropriate zip file for your project. They're already available on the website if you'd like to get started. So as I mentioned on the previous slide, the seller is the signatory to the index direct contract, and the bidder is the entity that submits the proposal. So this slide provides some examples for how to name these entities. If you're presenting a single project, then the bidder and the seller must be the same entity. If you're presenting multiple projects with multiple sellers, then we provide a couple of examples here. So in box three, you can see that you could use the parent entity as the bidder, or you can identify the bidder as a list of the seller's names separated by a comma. Once you begin filling out the online proposal form, you're going to be asked for the name of the project and to provide contact information for entities and authorized individuals that are applicable to the project in section one. For the seller and the bidder, you'll be required to provide the exact legal name of the entity and the address. You'll also name and provide contact information for an officer of the seller. This is an individual who will make all representations required in the Part 1 and Part 2 proposal for the seller, and this individual must be empowered to undertake contracts and bind the seller. You'll also provide contact information for up to four representatives. These are individuals that are authorized to act on behalf of the bidder and the seller, and they're going to be our main points of contact. They'll receive all correspondence from us, and they'll be responsible for responding to requests for additional information. If you're submitting multiple projects, then all representatives must be the same across your projects. Lastly, in section one, if the seller is an equity eligible contractor, then this bidder should indicate this and provide the required documented evidence that this is the case. And we have here in the final bullet the definition of an equity eligible contractor. In the Part 1 proposal, you'll provide basic information for your project. So this includes the system size and megawatt AC rating, the first date of operation, whether that's actual or expected, So projects that started operations prior to June 1, 2017 are not eligible for this RFP. Also in section 2, a bidder can submit evidence to support a higher capacity factor than 45% for utility scale wind or 30% for utility scale solar and brownfield. These capacity factors here on the slide, 45% and 30%, are used as an input to set the maximum annual quantity of RECs that a bidder can submit as part of its bid. So if you would like to support a higher capacity factor because that's what's applicable to your project, then you can submit to us a forecast of energy production and other relevant design specifications to support that. So there are requirements for some projects related to the project labor agreements. Construction activities for the project began prior to September 15, 2021, then this requirement does not apply to the project. If construction activities have begun as of the submission of Part 1 and did not begin prior to September 15, 2021, then you'll be required to provide evidence that the project labor agreements have been filed with the director of the IPA. That'll be due in Part 1. If construction activities have not begun as of the submission of Part 1, then the seller will certify that the project will be built by general contractors that have entered into a project labor agreement prior to construction. And they'll also acknowledge the requirements under the index ref contract and the terms and conditions that are defined by the Project Labor Agreements Act. If you are going to be submitting a project for construction activities that have begun so that this is applicable to your project, please do not delay in submitting the project labor agreements to the IPA using the address here on this slide. Now, in regards to the minimum equity standard, unless a project was operational prior to December 15, 2022, or the seller is an equity eligible contractor, then the officer of the seller will be required to acknowledge the minimum equity standard of 10% will apply to the project and that there are reporting requirements under the contract. In this section of the form, on an optional basis, a bidder can elect to commit to a higher equity level percentage that's greater than 10% in order to qualify for a bid evaluation price reduction that's described in the rules. There are additional requirements if you do choose this option. So the seller will make additional certifications acknowledging the additional reporting requirements and any penalties should the seller fail to demonstrate that they meet this higher standard. The bidder will be required to provide a narrative plan that describes how the seller will meet the higher level commitment. And then the bidder must also already have in place letters of intent to negotiate or contract with contractors or subcontractors that employ EEPs or provide evidence of current employment of EEPs for 50% times the higher equity level commitment times the projected number of workers from the narrative plan. So the required information regarding the project site is going to differ between utility scale wind and solar versus brownfield. So we're starting with this slide here that covers the requirements applicable to the utility scale projects. So applicants will provide the complete address for the project that could be street address or coordinates, along with a map of the project site that clearly shows the location of the project and is consistent with that address. Also in section 4, if the project located in a state adjacent to Illinois and that qualified on the basis of public interest criteria in the act, you'll go ahead and provide evidence that that is the case. So a project that's located in a state adjacent to Illinois must be pre-approved by the IPA to be eligible for Illinois RPS compliance. Currently on the IPA's website, there's an evaluation spreadsheet that's completed and submitted to the IPA for approval. So you would follow the link here on this slide to download the spreadsheet dated August 15, 2022, complete all of the required fields, and then email that form to the email address here. In return, the IPA will provide you with a document that confirms that the public interest criteria has been met, and then that's the evidence you'll submit with your proposal. Applicants will confirm in Section 4 whether the project site is located entirely within an energy transition community grant area. The list of these eligible areas are provided in Appendix 16 to the RFP rules. If your project is located in one of these areas, then you'll need to add the boundary of the grant area on the project site map. And then this map is what becomes an exhibit to the contract. So it's all very clear where the project will be built and that it will be within the Energy Transition Community grant area. So this slide and the next couple of slides pertain to qualifying a brownfield project site. So a brownfield site photovoltaic project must be located in Illinois. Applicants must provide the complete address for the project along with a map of the project site. And importantly, in this case, the project must be entirely contained within the brownfield site. If the project is co-located with a greenfield facility, then you'll just need to disclose that fact. But the project that's contained within the brownfield site will need to have a single dedicated meter and have its own account registered in PJM Gas or MRETS. The project site to qualify as brownfield must fit into one of the two buckets from the definition under the Act. The project site is either regulated by the U.S. EPA or Illinois EPA under one of the four programs in the Act, and I'll show those four programs on the next slide, or the project site is located at the site of a coal mine that has permanently ceased coal production, permanently halted any remining operations, and is no longer accepting coal combustion residues. So this slide provides the four programs on the left-hand side in which the project site must be regulated. And then on the right is a list of sufficient documentation that could be provided as evidence that the project is in fact regulated by that program. The procurement administrator will consider other forms of documentation that are provided. Any document that's submitted must be dated no earlier than 25 years prior to the bid date, so 25 years prior to December 8th, 2023. Notably, there are additional requirements for projects that are regulated by the IEPA Site Remediation Program, and they pertain to demonstrating actual blight or contamination of the project site, and they're described specifically in paragraph 4.5.5 of the RFP rules. So for a project located at the site of a permanently closed coal mine, the bidder must certify as part of its Part 1 proposal that the coal mine has ceased coal production, permanently halted remining operations, and is no longer accepting any coal combustion residues. Documentation listed here, 1, 2, and 3, must be provided in order for the project site to meet the definition from the Act. I just want to note that permits are required and evidence that the permit for coal mining operation was approved by the Department of Natural Resources, and they must be relevant to the project site, and the project site in this case may just be a portion of the coal mine. So with this next slide, we're back to discussing the eligibility requirements applicable to all categories of projects. So within Section 6 of the form, projects are required to meet a project maturity requirement. This can be accomplished by providing the documentation listed in the table from PJM, MISO, or utility, or by demonstrating site control for a portion of the project site. So you can provide a document from the table in this slide. So if you provide a document from the table on this slide, then you do not need to provide evidence of site control. But if you have not yet started the interconnection process, that's no problem. You can still qualify if you can show documented evidence of site control for a portion of the site. So this table here provides the required documentation to meet the project maturity requirement. So a copy of the completed system impact study from PJM, If interconnecting with MISO, if the project is in DPP 2020 cycle one or a later study cycle, you'll provide a copy of the preliminary system impact study under DPP one. Or if you entered an earlier study cycle with MISO, then you'll be asked to provide the fully executed interconnection agreement. If you're interconnecting with a utility, then you'll be asked to provide the fully executed interconnection agreement. So if these documents are not available, then you will, in the form, describe the stage of development of the project and, like I mentioned, demonstrate site control. So you can use this slide here to determine how much site control is required, if that's applicable. So at least 40 acres times the project size for a utility scale wind project, 4 acres times the project size for a utility scale solar project, and 3 acres times the project size for brownfield site photovoltaic project. This table on the slide provides some of the accepted documentation that you can use. There are many types of documents that are accepted, and you can provide different documents for different landowners. That's no problem. If you do end up using a letter of intent or a memorandum of understanding, then it will be required to satisfy specific minimum requirements that are available in Appendix 4 to the RFP rules. The seller will need to make a number of certifications regarding the project and the seller. These go into Section 7 of the form. Examples are that the project has or will have a single revenue quality meter and that there will be no substitution for another project. In regards to the seller, the officer will need to accept the terms of the Index Direct contract and make acknowledgement that the there are collateral requirements under the contract. These are just some of the examples. Importantly, also, the seller must certify that seller, including its contractors and subcontractors rendering services under the contract, will comply with the requirements of the Prevailing Wage Act. So this slide continues with the requirements in sections 8 and 9 of the proposal. If the seller or its guarantor is rated by one or more of the major rating agencies, S&P, Moody's, or Fitch, then all available credit ratings must be provided. This information is used for a credit assessment under the contract that is provided back to the bidder before entering the contract. So everything is clear whether or not the guarantor or seller met the requirements under the contract. It is not a requirement for the seller to be rated or to have a rated guarantor in order to participate in this RFP. In Section 9, this is also where the bidder will provide evidence that payment of the bid participation fee was made. If you plan to use a letter of credit to post financial guarantees under the Index Direct contract, should you be a winner in the RFP, it is a good idea to begin working with your financial institution to get these documents in place in time. You can download 2 options for the post-bid letter of credit that's provided as exhibits to the Index Direct contract. You have an opportunity with the Part 1 to submit red lines with changes requested by your financial institution for review by the companies. So you can submit these red lines by email to us or by upload to the Part 1 form. Currently on the website, there are already lists of preliminary lists of modifications that are acceptable to each company. So you can go ahead and review that list as well, share it with your financial institution. If you do submit a red line for review and your modification is accepted by the company, then that modification would be added to this preliminary list and could be used by any bidder. With the Part 1, you can also provide comments on or propose modifications to the pre-bid letter of credit for each company. The pre-bid letter of credit is an option to be used to meet the bid assurance collateral requirement with the Part 2 proposal. So there are 2 versions of the pre-bid letter of credit for a company, and they have different terms. There's an electronic version that will accommodate transmission by the issuing bank by electronic means. And then there's a hard copy version, which accommodates transmission by the issuing bank via overnight delivery service. So it really depends on how your issuing bank wants to deliver the letter of credit. And then you can choose the version that's most appropriate. Again, there are preliminary lists of modifications that are acceptable to each company that are already posted to the procurement website. So once you have completed the form for a project and you're ready to submit it to us for review, you'll click submit on the online form, and then we will evaluate it promptly. While we evaluate your proposal, you'll be temporarily locked out of the account for that project. Then we're going to provide a notice back to you as soon as the evaluation is complete. It'll either say, hey, your proposal is complete, or it's going to list items to clarify or items that need further, you know, supported documentation in order to mark your proposal complete. And with that, we'll provide you with a deadline. So generally, bidders are given until the part one date or 2 business days, whichever is later, to respond to a first request for additional information. So again, the part one date when your part one proposal must be submitted is October 31st. The part one notification when you're informed that you can submit a part two proposal is November 14th. So with your part one proposal, you're going to receive a letter from us that notifies you of the project's qualified status. You'll get a customized bid form that you'll use for submitting bids for all of your qualified projects. We'll send you instructions for completing and submitting the bid form on the bid date, an invitation to a training session to practice the bid submission procedure, confidential credentials for submission of the bid form via the online secure transfer system, and also detailed instructions for providing the bid assurance collateral to the companies. If your project's qualified, then you'll begin submitting your part two materials the following day. So by the part two date on December 1st, you'll need to provide the first 3 bullets on this slide. You'll submit information through the part two form. You'll upload and or email signed certifications, and you'll also submit that bid assurance collateral to each of the companies. The bids are part of the part two proposal, but again, they're not due until the bid date on December 8th. So specifically, some of the requirements of the online form for part two include electing the form of bid assurance collateral, either cash or a letter of credit. If applicable, submitting evidence that the IPA determined the project labor agreements submitted for the project do in fact meet the requirements. And also you'll provide an indicative quantity for the project. The indicative quantity is an annual number of RECs that the applicant plans to bid, but it's entirely non-binding at the point of the Part 2 form submission on December 1st. So this slide here provides the required bid assurance collateral amounts. Bid assurance collateral is a function of the size of the project. The amounts are on a dollar or on a per megawatt basis applicable to each company. An example for how to calculate the bid assurance collateral for a wind project is provided here on this slide. So for example, if you're submitting for a wind project that's 200 megawatts, the required amount would be for Ameren $320,000 or 1600 times 200,000 or 200 megawatts, for ComEd $800,000, and for MidAmerican, $80,000. If a bidder presents proposals for multiple projects, then a bidder may submit a single pre-bid letter of credit or effect a single wire transfer to the company in the amount required across all of the projects. This slide provides some additional requirements related to the bid assurance collateral. So if you're submitting cash, you'll need to provide a W-9 for the entity to which cash will be returned. We provide samples of this request on the procurement website. You'll also need to acknowledge the conditions under which cash could be drawn upon. If you're submitting a pre-bid letter of credit for a company, your bank will use either the electronic version or the hard copy version. The electronic versions are appendices 5-7 on the procurement website and must be submitted by electronic means. The hard copy versions are appendices 8-10 and must be submitted by overnight delivery. If you're using the hard copy version, it's highly recommended that you ask the bank to submit a PDF version as well as a tracking number so that the company can track the package. So I point out that there are appendices, and that's because a pre-bid letter of credit for a company must be in the standard form or only incorporate modifications acceptable to that company and applicable specifically to either the electronic version or the hard copy version. And again, we will send detailed instructions for submission of bid assurance collateral along with the Part 1 notification to all qualified bidders. I just want to note that if you are using cash to post your bid assurance collateral, that cash can be used to meet performance assurance under the contract should the project have a winning bid. So that concludes the overview of the qualification process. This is the final section of the presentation, and it's going to cover protocols for submission of bids and steps of the post-bid process. So a customized bid form that we provide to each bidder is the exclusive method for submitting bids. Bid forms are submitted to a secure bid transfer site on the bid date on December 8th during a bid window from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. noon. If the bid form is not completely filled out or is inconsistent with the rules, then it will not be evaluated on the bid date. So in order to avoid that situation, once the bid window closes, there's going to be a cure deficiency period of an hour, and we ask that everyone's available during this period so that we can get in contact with you and remedy any issues before that 1 hour period closes. And we will be providing step-by-step guide to bidders on how to fill out the bid form and submit it. And then again, there will be an opportunity to practice the bid submission procedures during a training. There's also a backup method by email should a bidder experience any technical issues with the online site on the bid date. So as Ben said, your bid's going to have three core elements. You're going to provide a strike price for the project in dollar per megawatt hour. You'll provide a full quantity that represents the annual quantity of RECs the seller is offering to deliver. And you'll also provide a minimum quantity that represents the minimum annual quantity of RECs that the seller is willing to accept as a partial award. So a project may receive a partial award, so an amount less than the full quantity, but never below the minimum quantity if that project is the marginal project selected during bid evaluation. So the marginal project is the project that, if selected, would mean exceeding the target for the category. So we have an example here on this slide in the dark purple cells. This hypothetical 100 megawatt wind project is bidding to deliver an annual quantity of 300,000 RECs. The bidder inputted a minimum quantity that's less than the full quantity. So the bidder is indicating that it would accept a partial award of no less than 250,000 RECs at a strike price of $100 per megawatt hour. So this means if it's not possible to select at least 250,000 RECs, then this project would not be selected. Importantly, a note here that for each project, the bidder must select an index hub, either MISO Illinois hub or PJM NI hub. And this hub is gonna be used for purposes of payment under the contract for that project. So the bid evaluation will proceed independently for each category. Wind competes with wind, brownfield competes with brownfield, utility scale solar only with utility scale solar. So bids with strike prices that fail to meet or beat the benchmark for a category will be eliminated. Next, the lowest strike price submitted for each category is identified and used in order to adjust the strike price that has been submitted for projects that committed to an equity level for the project greater than the minimum equity standard of 10%, or also for projects that are utility scale wind or solar that are located entirely within an energy transition community grant area. So for purposes of ranking, those strike prices are adjusted down. Next, the bids are ranked from lowest to highest, incorporating those adjusted strike prices. And in order of strike price, the full quantities of projects with the lowest strike prices are selected until all projects are selected or until selecting the project with the next highest strike price would exceed the target. Then, if the remaining target is less than the minimum quantity for the marginal project, the marginal project would be selected at the minimum quantity as long as this results in exceeding a target for the category by no more than an additional 50% of the target. So the possibility to exceed the target by up to an additional 50% when selecting the marginal project was new, beginning with the prior procurement event. It has been maintained here. If the target would be exceeded by more than 50%, then the project not selected and the target for that category would remain unfilled. Lastly, the projects with bids that are approved by the commission will have their RECs allocated to each company. And we post an Appendix 15 to the RFP rules on our website that has an example of this process and importantly, an example of how we adjust the strike prices. So just two more slides here. Importantly, on the bid date, the procurement administrator expects to notify bidders by 6 p.m. whether their bids are being identified as a winning bid. Then within 2 business days of the bid date, the procurement administrator and the procurement monitor each submit a confidential report to the ICC on the results. And then within 2 business days of receipts of the report, the ICC will decide whether to accept or reject the results. Once the commission renders its decision, each company will send partially executed contract documents to the seller. The seller then countersigns and sends the contract documents electronically back and fulfills the creditworthiness requirements. And we will send instructions regarding these execution procedures to bidders with qualified projects ahead of time. A note here that the collateral requirement under the index rec contract would be due within 8 business days of approval by the commission, and payment of supplier fees to the IPA is due within 7 business days of approval of the results. So that concludes the presentation portion of this presentation.